My guest today in the arena is Neil Barm, a wonderful person in our game, been unbelievably successful in the roles that he's played. And the thing is I love about Neil, whilst he had this imposing demeanour as an athlete in the game and probably was seen as one of the aggressors of his era, there's this wonderful subtlety in what he actually brings as a leader now. And it's a career which is now successfully, he's played a major role, an important role in 8 premierships. But the last 6 is almost as someone who becomes the reason why teams win the premierships, but without him actually having his hands on the levers, the subtlety of leadership, the nuance, the insight. And whilst this is more a football conversation than perhaps some of the more recent ones, and that's certainly the place where Neil comes from, there is these depth of lessons in this conversation, which I think are so important for leaders who are trying to lead in a way which is, one, I think gives you the best chance of being successful by creating environments that other people feel good about themselves, but also just recognising that it's okay to be you as a leader and have that confidence to be you and to find the best part of you in regard to your leadership. So enjoy this conversation with the one and only Neil Barm as he joins me in the arena. Hey, welcome into the arena with one of my favourite people of all time, the great Neil Barm.
He says that to everyone.
This is true, because you actually gave me my I had very few sporting highlights as a competitor, but it goes right back to the Tiger Little League days where we're playing a game against Carlton and Carlton Richmond in the 70s, pretty big time, probably 60 to 70,000 people there. And I just run out onto the ground, and as I'm running past you, you go, "G'day, young schwabby." As I'm going past, I'm 10 years of age, and there's not many things I remember from my time in sport, but it's actually struck me since I've got to know you that just even that the fact that you would recognise a young kid running out onto the MCG at halftime in a big game probably says a little bit about your sporting contradiction, but also your sporting disposition as well. That because I've heard these other stories where you play like Tigers and you've walked down the race going grrr. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I've always believed that ridiculous setup. You know, we're going to this and we're going to that had nothing to do with what you actually did,
right?
And Barry Richardson is a good mate of mine. He used to said, I have to stay away from you just before the game because he'll always say something that Tommy's not saying, like, "Oh, can you imagine having a glass of Black Label about now?" And I was only doing it just to prove to myself that it wasn't that, it doesn't matter, you'll be okay, don't be too worried about it. It was almost my way of dealing with my own anxiety. I didn't have anxiety, but you know, the game's about to start. You can do it. You've always done this. You can do it again. Just don't worry about it. Just go out and play.
Yeah.
You know, rather than getting over the top with it all. So people who played against me probably wouldn't believe that's that's what I did. But people often, we talk about those days then and, you know, the kind of aggression and all that sort of stuff. But I never played angry. I was never like that. It was just, no. You just do what I felt I had to do was play the game. So, I mean, that sounds like I'm being apologetic, but that was kind of what I recall.
Is it a reflection, or was it a conscious thing at the time? Because definitely the world would have thought this is an angry man who's playing the game, and probably then that was a reputation you then had to carry forward in so many ways.
Well, I felt, The attitude around our club was very much, you know, win at all costs, you know, kill or be killed, et cetera, et cetera. In that sense, do everything you can to make sure we win. And I think we got away with a bit more in those days. And I genuinely never, ever played angry. That was not what I was doing. It was not personal in a sense. It was just, it's what I thought I had to do to help us win and to make it difficult for the other team to win, if you know what I mean. When I look back at it, I took a pretty serious risk. I mean, so someone could have, you know, really got a hold of me, and I was just playing the way I felt we needed to play. I mean, it was 90%, you know, playing, but every now and again you needed to impose yourself on the opposition, and that's, I felt that I sort of had to do that. Not had to do that, I chose to do it, but felt that that's what my teammates and the coach, etc., expected me to do. No one ever said, go out there and, you know, do this. It was just play as hard as you can.
And the Richmond teams did, and they were successful.
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
So the football success in terms of playing comes early for you, really. You're still a young guy, aren't you, when you...
Well, yeah, funnily enough, I played in 72, 73 and 74 grand finals in a row. And what was I? 21, 22, something like that. And I thought this is going to go on forever. But it was a wonderful experience, I must say.
And then your footy mortality comes pretty early, really, doesn't it? You have knees when you're not supposed to have knees.
Yes, I had – I mean, I had a – I think they used to call them cartilages in those days. I had a cartilage out in early 70, I reckon. So I'd started to have a bit of problem with them from the outset. And I was all right for a while, but then they just wore out. Like I couldn't play after – I only played a couple of games in 79, I think, and I was only 27. So, you know, I just couldn't run. So I gave it away.
Tigers win in 1980, so yeah.
Yeah, I'd gone to Adelaide by then was coaching the Norwood Footy Club, which was one of the, you know, best things I've ever done in footy. I learned so much, you know, from them.
And I've heard you speak about that a little bit, that because you would have arrived in Adelaide with the reputation that you had as a big man enforcer, and you still were playing a little bit at that point when you first...
Yeah, I didn't play at all in 80, but they convinced me to play a bit in 81. I played probably a dozen games or so in 81, but I was, you know, only half a player. I was still running, but not that much. And funnily enough, in 82, I was sort of thinking about playing again, and I played a practice game against South Fremantle, and Mel Brown was coaching, and Mel Brown always says what he thinks, and he's a friend. So he's coaching them, I'm coaching Norwood, and played a bit. And I said to him after the game, you know, having a good chat, and he said, well, what do you think I should do? Should I play or should I coach? He said, coach. That was a bit of a reflection of how I was playing. So I didn't play after that. But it was right. I was, you know, couldn't move as well as I should. You know.
And in terms of the coaching, what was it, the part that Norwood perhaps saw in you at that stage, at say 27 years of age, and they're going to, and Norwood's a wonderful club, like it's been one of the great, you know, sporting clubs of Australian footy, with some wonderful people. What part of you do you think they saw?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, at the time I wasn't thinking like that of who I was as who I was, but I think they got, they'd spoken to Sheeds, and they would have spoken to Tommy as well, and I think they'd spoken to Barry Richardson as well about, you know, all the people they were looking at, and they all fortunately said, oh, you know, you really should look at this bloke. He's got a bit more than you realise. He's not just what he's seen to be. So I think they were, you know, hoping that I had a bit more depth to my personality than just being aggressive and competitive. And we had, you know, quite a few discussions, and I think they probably saw that, but it was an enormous risk for them to take. I mean, if we go back then, Norwood was a, you know, very much an established club, quite successful, you know, and reasonably conservative in a sense. They're an eastern suburbs club and all that sort of stuff. So they took quite a significant risk in appointing me, I think. And I've really thanked them so much for that over the journey, because it really helped me, because apart from only being what I was and who I was, I hadn't had any experience in coaching at all, and to coach, you know, an SA NFL team was a pretty significant job. Part-time, obviously. Part-time money, but full-time commitment.
Huge expectation.
Yeah. So I think they saw the fact that I was reasonably open-minded, but pretty broad a strong disposition, and that the players would sort of look up to me a little bit at first, as long as I told them the right stories. So, I mean, the best thing that happened to me was actually going there, because I think I was a bit unusual in terms of coaches. I actually listened to what people were saying in those days. Coaching was a bit of a trumpet blower. Just do what do what you're told, and I know everything. But I think I saw, even when we were playing at Richmond and under Tommy, who was a wonderful coach, wonderful person, and we played fantastic footy, but in my mind I saw it as, we're not really taking advantage of all the opportunities that footy gives. We were very much, I mean, one of Tommy's sayings was no finessing, meaning he didn't want you to try this other stuff. Just contest, barrel it in, kick it as long as you can, and we'll, our system will work that out, which it did. And he wouldn't have called it a system, but it was a system.
That was very much a system.
Yeah, and I remember when I was playing as a key forward there, like every time you went for a mark, I had to beat seven other blokes. I mean, three of ours and four of them, in a sense, because everyone knew where it was going. But because we did that and because we had people like KB and a few others, that was the way to play. But I could see there's another way. There's more things you can do. And particularly, you know, when we played with, say, Ian Stewart, he used to kick it to where you needed to lead rather than you lead to him. So, you know, you think, well, there is something in this. So I think that's one of the good things that I was able to take out of the Norwood thing. South Australian footy was different to Victorian footy, though the influence of particularly Jack Odie, I think, was that, and the other coaches would have read it as well, is that it was more use of the ball, more taking opportunities, more using space, more 45-degree kick, more handball, handball, handball. So there was a different way of playing, and whilst, you know, the Victorian way was they'd probably win the game, but it was more through power and talent, whatever, than system, in my opinion. And that helped me enormously because I got to learn about what footy was all about, in a sense, I think.
I often think about, it's talked often in this way, sort of the mechanics and dynamics of the game, and the mechanics being, say, you know, the Tommy system, the Jack Odie system, whatever it might be. So even in you're effectively learning a different mechanic, weren't you, and how the game should be played. And you almost in many ways became, when you then come back and coach after successfully coaching at Norwood and come back and coach Melbourne, you're seen as almost bringing back a different mechanic into the way of playing. Would that be fair?
Well, it was a bit different. I don't, you know, you kind of don't look at it that way from yourself. I only saw what I saw and encouraged the blokes to play as well as they could and use the opportunities they had as much as they could. So I always had this view on, you know, like if you just get it and kick it, you're probably kicking it to them. Now, if you just get it and kick it when you have to, well, we've got to read that and be in the right place. But usually there'll be an opportunity to do something else. If you've got any time and make the people around you, let's use each other. And that's why handball back even, you know, in some of the teams, never handball backwards, whereas it was probably the best place to go at times because no one thought you were going to go there. But as long as your handball backwards was to someone who had some space, and you know, I've always been first give player, but even as a player I think I probably certainly handballed more than KB did, but I was much more of a handball set-up player than just a kicker. So it was just the way I saw the game, I think.
The reason I bring that is that your superpower I know you wouldn't like that term, but your capacity to understand the dynamics within groups and particularly from a leadership perspective and I love the book with Anson Cameron. I really recommend it.
He wrote it well, didn't he?
Yeah, it's beautifully written. Yeah. And I think the fact that you went to someone who wasn't a traditional sort of football writer really added that dimension to it.
Yeah, the autobiography stuff is often just, you know, this is what I think, but he did it really well in that, you know, I knew him pretty well. I'd read all his books already and I knew the way he wrote. But what he did, we talked about my life in footy for months and then he went out, and I went out and found the truth. But it was he'd got the other opinion, so it became a book about 50 years in footy rather than a book about me, in a sense, you know, whilst obviously it related to where I was. So I found that a really good way of having written it. And he did write it beautifully, I thought.
And that was the layers, which I found. But the layers sort of came back to some pretty clear philosophies. But there was something which I was really taken by in regard to that balance between the people who listen to this podcast will be very much aware of this, the balance between sort of personal drive and team contribution, if you like, you know, what you need from the people versus and then their role in a team environment. But there's a quote in it. It says, in our game, if you don't have belief in yourself, if you don't have a big ego and really high standards, you're no good to us. But if it's all about you, you're no fucking good to us.
Did I swear?
And we are allowed to hear just quietly. Yeah, so when you hear that back, how much does that draw on what you think in terms of performance inside a team environment?
Well, I think it's the ultimate personally, but particular, we're lucky in our game that the game is all about people and players, because it is. There's nothing else. There's goalposts and the ground and all that. But it's all about how you know, it's the biggest team game in the world, I think, apart from a war, I suppose. But, I mean, it does rely so much on everyone being there for each other and, you know, doing what they have to do to help the movement of the other person, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you can't get away from that. But you also can't get away from the fact that if you don't get the game and you don't have talented players, you can't win. But it's not all about that. If you had most of the talented players, but you didn't have teamwork, you didn't have care, I'm not sure how well you'd go. You'd win some games by 100 goals, but you'd lose a lot of games as well, in my opinion. So I think that, you know, I've obviously called it the multiplier effect, or working together, or, you know, 1 and 1 = 3, or whatever the terminology is. But if what you're doing is driven by what makes it better for everyone else as well as for yourself, that's very, very powerful. So it means that, you know, you are playing your role. You are doing what you need to do for other blokes in the team. And now our games are much more complex in the way they're set up, but it's all based on that, right? If you go, you run over there, you're making space for him. Now, no one's going to see that and no one counts that, but if you don't do it, we don't win. And I think there's so much of that so powerful. But the first bit is, if you're playing our game, I have to, as a coach, encourage you to be, or drive you to be, elite, as good as you can be, whatever that is. So that's, and you need then to have belief in yourself and have that strong ego and all that sort of stuff. Otherwise, you're not going to be as good as you can be, because that's the reason you're there. But then you've got to turn that into what's good for us rather than just what's good for you. And that does need sort of open-minded lateral thinkers, and a lot of those people who are so highly driven aren't necessarily naturally that, but somehow you've got to get with them and encourage them to understand that what you're doing and what he's doing, if the two of you are a bit really highly driven, you need to, what about we help each other be as good as we can be, not try and be better than him, in a sense. So, I mean, it's a lot of words about simple things, but it's simply that encourage people to be team first, understand that team first actually satisfies what you need as well, and et cetera, and vice versa.
Yeah, that's a great statement. So team first actually satisfies what you need as well.
Yeah, well, it does. I think it does. Well, it definitely does, because really, regardless of how good a player you are, still the thing that's mostly recognised in all players, how many premierships did you play in? Which is probably not fair, but it's really what everyone drives towards. So if you won 3 Brownlows and played in 3 premierships, you're a pretty good player. I mean, Dusty Martin wins the Norm Smith medal in 3 premiership whatevers. I mean, that says something about him. Mm.
Interesting word that you use in all of that is care, because I wouldn't necessarily think that would be the first word which comes to mind, but you threw it in really early in the piece.
Well, but I think it's right. It is care. It's I mean, that sounds like a soft thing, but it's not. It's very powerful, and that's one of the most powerful things in the world. You actually care for other people. You're probably not going to stab them, or you're not going to pinch their car. Or, I mean, if all people really did care, well, we're in probably a pretty good place. Now, you go back to wartime. Well, you've got to care about your people, but you don't care about the others, and that's not ideal. And probably I played that way. I cared about my teammates, but maybe didn't care about my opponents enough. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been quite as aggressive, perhaps. But that wasn't in the mindset in those days. So, I mean, I forgive it by saying it wasn't far away from the Vietnam War, and we were still allowed to over the hill and kill people, whereas that happens now in some parts of the world, but certainly not in the Australian view. But maybe too philosophical, but.
How do you manage the sort of the tension between the two, where, you know, and I often joke that, and I'm talking mainly about the men's game. I think the women's game's different in regard to this, but you know, you've had experience obviously in both, and I'd be interested in those differences, is we recruit the most selfish human beings known to mankind, the 18-year-old male, and we have to educate them in the way that you're talking about, you know, that if you can't, yeah, get the best from yourself, but if you're not prepared, you know, so what... What conditions do the clubs need to create to actually for that to happen? And And in the context of, you know, the world, you know, in terms of business, we're actually asking people to do the same thing, often in a less obvious team environment in business in that way. But you would have seen that because the role you played, you had to see that across the club as well as within the team. And the team, it's a fairly obvious version of that. But you would have seen it in the role you played as a senior person inside, you know, great football clubs as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the some time ago, the coach or the main person was that way as well. You could see that, yeah, they were totally driven. They were selfish about what they needed to do and selfish in terms of the way they coached their players. Just play well and I'll look after you. Don't play well and you're gone, etc. And that there is some power, a lot of power in that, obviously. I mean, there'd be no Adolf Hitler if that didn't work, if you know what I mean. So what you've got to do is recognise that and then take the good parts out of that and push them, but take the bad parts out and try and sell them to the other people. And the other people, even the 18-year-olds who are very much, you know, self-interested, et cetera, in there somewhere there's a recognition of the other things, like, you know, they've got a mum and dad, was it good? They've got people who live next door. You don't have to beat everyone, and how does that relate to what we want you to do? And then it's, you know, relationships between their mates within it, the kind of behaviour that you as the coach and you as the president or whatever show is valued in this place. That's right, that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do. And the extreme ones either play that well, you have to put up with them, or they have to go because you've got to fit into the environment somehow. But most will. But you've got to have the will to do it yourself, to actually make sure they do fit in. Don't just let people go along. Allow them to be themselves, but make sure they're driven by what we need rather than just what they need, which it's a lot easier to say than it is to do. But that's the reality of it in my view.
And how do you define those things? What the sort of, it's almost above the line, below the line type stuff. You know, the above the line aspects of any organisation, I think, is some sort of combination of the stuff that's important, the values or the principles, or, you know, whichever way you want to think about it. But also the standards and the expectations, which, you know, can be very related, but standards in sport and standards in organisations.
Yeah, well, I think that's got the management, in a sense, has got to know what we want to do with that. But then if you don't then engage the players in that decision making
to define it,
yeah, you won't get them to buy. You can't just say, oh, we do this, this, this and this and get off your ass and do it, sort of thing. You've really got to say, well, this is what we want to do, this is what we believe, what do you think? And then they will come, if not come up with the values that they want to play to and come up with the behaviours they accept, they'll at least have an idea about it, and you've engaged them with it. So all of a sudden they think, it's theirs, but accept that we've agreed to this, so you do it. And that's probably the most powerful thing you can do. That's why we've got leadership groups and all that sort of stuff, so they can actually do that. Because in the old days you would tell them, do this, do what you're told, regimentation, and, you know, 20% of them would say, oh, yeah, fair enough, I get it. You know, if you're talking to Steve Gernand, it wouldn't matter who was in charge because But most of them have got a bit more in their minds to say, well, okay, well, what do I want to do this for? So you have to do it. I think the most powerful organisations then become the ones that have their people who have to perform have had a say or at least ticked off on the way that they're going to be valued and judged, et cetera, I think. Does that sound too, like, but I believe that's the only way you can guarantee that you'll get that team thing.
Yeah, and I'm almost certain it is that, but most people would think of sort of the regimented aspects of elite environments as much more as we extract performance rather than unlock performance.
Well, in some ways, that's still got to be there. You know, the way you train, you've got to – well, it is regimented. You know, like the pre-season training you do, they go, so, well, you're going to run 100-100s or whatever you do. No one really wants to do that. But in the end they go, well, okay, I've agreed to this and we're trying to do this and this is our objective and this – and the one part that's got to be done is we've got to push ourselves and da-da-da-da. So they kind of accept what they have to do. In the good old days, we say, oh, what the hell are we doing this for? Because we weren't involved with it. I mean, but we sort of did impose that. I always remember in 79, our pre-season, they said no water. And a lot of the people, they said, yeah, we know that. Weak as water. Like, yeah. You don't need water, just push yourself. Yeah. You know, they put you in jail if you did that now, I reckon. But that was imposing the standards on you rather than letting you work it out, not work it out for yourself, but understand that we've agreed to it, let's do it. So,
yeah.
I remember in one of the cold waters, I remember he was trying to do the 100-100s and he collapsed.
Right.
he's
home story, isn't it? You know? Yeah. And literally, I can often remember players collapsing in because they were dehydrated.
Well, he was. He looked at his eyes. You couldn't see his eyes. He's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it is the concept, really. I'm not sure if there's a more important.
I don't know if there was any pun in the Waterson name.
No, it couldn't have been a play on it. Yeah, end up having a terrific career. He's one of those players you had a terrific career in Perth, and I always wondered why he never come back into the system because he always looked like he was a good possibility. But that idea of is there anything more important than buy-in in a footy club that we're buying in?
In my opinion, no, not at all. People, you can tell people what to do, and that might be good if you know if you're God, if you know what I mean, if you know what everything's right. But mostly, it's selling it to them and them actually buying in.
Yeah.
Because I was just talking to Brett Ratton yesterday about something, and he said something. Well, I told him what to do. And we both said, there's about four steps after that. You're right to tell him. But the buy-in is actually understanding and then, genuinely understanding and then actually practicing and being able to do it. So if they don't buy in, it ain't ever going to happen.
Yeah. And so really the process of their playing a role in the development of those things is really just increasing the possibility of buy-in in that way. So if you involve, particularly I think, I'm really interested in what you found when you went to Richmond in 2016 and obviously win the premiership the next year, is concepts around, I just love a really simple notion. Do people understand what we're trying to do and how their contribution matters to what we're trying to do?
Yeah, and in the old days they'd say, oh, don't worry about that, that's been soft. They're here. Let's tell them what to do and they'll do what they're told. Because that was you probably almost had to then because we didn't have, you had one coach and one assistant and the chairman's electors and secretary and something. So you probably had to, look, I'm the one who's telling you what to do, just do what you're told. And in a funny way, Tommy was actually before his time because whilst he did that, as a person you knew you could ask him why, and he'd probably tell you just, this is what we do. But you also knew that he actually believed in you. And I know that's what everyone says about all coaches, but with Tommy, you genuinely did. He bought into his people, so we bought into him, even if you didn't agree completely with the simplicity of the game.
How did he make you feel that way? What was it about him that made you feel as though he really...
Well, yeah, it wasn't really much what he said. It's what he didn't say. I mean, he never said you're weak as water, unless you were, unless you did something really wrong. Obviously, it would help you get through it. But it was more that he knew that you were trying to do the right thing, particularly in playing. I think he forgave some of the stuff that he believed in outside, like we were a bit naughty, we had a few beers and he never did and all that sort of. But he kind of knew that. But as long as we committed to ourselves to what had to happen, particularly match day, not in training as well, but more so match day, you just knew that he gave you the tick.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I felt anyway, and I really felt that he believed in me as a player, and there was a lot of things that he could have decided that I wasn't doing as well as I could, but he was always a positive vibe that he always just go and play.
There's something...
But so, yeah, that was sort of off the mark. What were we talking about?
No, it's important because is that... Because clearly there would have been differences at a philosophical level between
you and Tony. Absolutely, yeah.
But you always sensed that he believed in you.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's one of those things. I often use Tommy as an example. There's people you meet in life who, clearly, particularly in leadership roles where you go, there's something about you that I'm attracted to. You know, they can be in a room, they've got charisma, they've got a certain way. And Tommy definitely had that. You were aware, you know, he looked at me
in
bucks.
Yeah, it was an unusual charisma though. He wasn't blowing his own trumpet.
No,
he
not was, at all.
It was just his presence, yeah.
Yeah, and so you felt good about Tommy when you met Tommy.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I think his thing was he actually made you feel good about you.
Well, that's kind of what I meant. I think he was before his time in that sense.
But that's my sense of you as well. That you can be in an environment where, you know, people feel good about you. You've got a physical stature, humorous, all those sorts of things. But very quickly, you focus back on the person themselves and how that person feels about themselves. Would that?
Yeah, I think unfortunately that's natural for me. I don't have to sort of make it up. And obviously that's from mum and dad or somewhere or whatever. But so I'm a natural team person in myself. I've still got, as we said, that crazy egotism and drive. I still believe in myself, but I genuinely want other people to be as good as they can be when I'm around them.
Yeah.
And that sounds like I'm pumping myself up, but that's I genuinely feel that.
Yeah. And you would have no one argue that.
Well, that's when we had that function, leaving Richmond function, and there was, 300 people in the room, and I'm not used to it, but I had 300 people in the room and everyone was nice to me. It's not usual.
It wasn't a Carlton room.
It's not a footy environment.
So I'm interested in what that then asks of you, because you talk to care, for example. Care's not a low cost to at an emotional level to, you know, there is an emotional cost in caring. Obviously it gives back in that way. But, you know, one of the thoughts, and this is from, again, another quote from the book, this time Steve White, and I'll get you to explain who Steve White is in a moment. I know, but just for everyone else. Even a man at his age, and I know you're still a young bloke, he still takes enormous risks with his own emotional welfare if he thinks it's going to help someone else. If you don't take the risk, who will? Is sort of the idea. Does that resonate with you?
Oh, it's very kind of him to say it, but we did work pretty closely together, but he's about as mad as I am in a way.
So he's an ex-copper.
He's working in the don't take drugs area at the minute, I think. But I'm sure he loves it. But no, he's a terrific person. I do believe that, and that's why I'm a natural sort of team person. I quickly changed. Like I'm now working for Adelaide Footy Club. You know, everyone said, "What the hell are you doing that for?" And I went to their first game a couple of weeks ago, and I've never been so excited about a game of footy in my life. And I'm 73, for God's sake.
So there's still the pure love of the game.
I've still got that, and I'm very much part of Adelaide Footy Club. And how does that happen? But then I've been to there, and there. And every time I go there to the new club, I get nearly always have gone there for the right reason. You know, there's never been a negativity about leaving somewhere apart from the odd time, Melbourne. Some bloke chased me around the park to tell me I got the sack.
that was me,
But fortunately that's in my nature, and I'm sort of a natural team player. Sounds silly, but I think I am, fortunately.
But it asks a lot of you, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does, but I never consider that because I think that's who I am. I don't go, well, I've got to sacrifice something here to make sure this happens. Mm. I think that's the most important thing to do, so I do it. Mm. And it does relate to, you know, most people I'm involved with. You have to be a pretty unpleasant, nasty person for me to be crook on you, put it that way.
Yeah. No,
that's happened every now and again, but not often.
No, and I'm sure it does. But you seem like you're someone who forgives quickly and forgives easily.
Yeah, well, I probably do. I mean, even Carmel says I do that too much. But
and I think part of that often is that it's your partner who recognises and realises, you know, the sort of the depth of the pain and the turmoil all that, and in that sense. And one of the things which it seems that you build really strongly on sort of mutuality, that if you give and you hope to get back, but you don't expect to get back. And so therefore it's probably a bit contradictory to what I just said. So there's not the expectation of mutuality. I'm going to give you something here and perhaps that we'll get something back, not me personally, but for the good of the team, the good of the club.
Yes, I never – I do what I do because it's the right thing to do. I don't then expect necessarily to get the same, you know, or to get anything for it.
Yeah.
But I think that's being a human, I reckon. That's what we all need to do. I mean, I look at the world and I get so frustrated for some of the stuff that goes on. But then I know why it does. But, you know, people need to really drive to do something that they want. But, you know, awful. And that's one of the awful things about life is a lot of the things have happened because of religion and belief in a, you know, an organisation. And then nearly all of them, if you read what they're about, it's fantastic. It's what they should be about, but unfortunately they do a lot of things on the back of that that are really not the right thing to do. And a lot of it is because, you know, religion's really about men and women rather than just the religion. But you can easily find a motivation and a reason to do something that's wrong easily if you want to, but and maybe I have a few times, but most times I don't.
And sport does provide those opportunities, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, sport's wonderful. I've been lucky to have so long in even in one sport, but I love sport. You know, I love watching Test cricket even. What about that last game? Well, anyway. No, I do. I enjoy it. And, you know, even I've sort of seen a bit of soccer over the years and never not been that engaged with it. Then I watched the Matildas play, and I know it's pathetically soft, but for me to say that just because I saw that, and you think, oh, yeah, that is fantastic. What a... wonderful skill. And, you know, I genuinely like sport for that reason, that if people work together well and they get an outcome, it's something, you know, worth cherishing, I think.
How do you go with people when it's not about that? Because the conversation around leadership, it's impossible to have a conversation about leadership without talking about the things we're talking about, in my view, yeah. The sort of the dynamic, the team, those sorts of things. But there's always going to be conversation about power as well. People seek to gain it and to hold it and to hold power over. And you would have seen that.
Yeah, well, I try to help people with that, but if I can't, I try and then I need to not be involved because I see it as probably the greatest negative, particularly in organisations and sport. You look at it all, and I think the best test of any organisation is to say, have a look at the people with power, how do they behave? Do they just look after themselves, or have they got some sort of feeling for the others and try and help them? Now, people might say that's a bit, you know, Chardonnay lefty, a bit soft or whatever it is, but that's the reality of it, because people can't do as well as they can do if the person at the top is not really helping them to do that, if they're only looking after themselves. And when you've – a lot of people have had positions of power that are impossible to stop. Mm. They just do what they like. Mm. And, you know, even some of the organisations around. But, I mean, that's one of the things that I have nightmares about. I hate it because it's not necessary. But, you know, in a world where you're there to make as much money as you can and all that sort of stuff, well, sometimes power drives that a fair bit, but not sometimes, mostly. But I don't know what you do about it apart from recognise it. But then sometimes that you suffer badly for that.
And the organisation does.
Well, I think it does. I mean, some people would say it doesn't. I mean, maybe some organisations need that kind of drive, but, you know, probably most of them are bikies, gangs or crook organisations selling drugs or something. I shouldn't say that, but, yeah, I think they do suffer for it ultimately, but that's my opinion.
And it seems that when, you know, the most recent great success story that you've been involved with, and contemporary one, and it's already refashioning itself, is, you know, coming back to Richmond, in the club that you played with. It seemed that when you came back that there was the people in power were certainly something totally the opposite of the type of people we're talking about, people like Peggy O'Neill and obviously Brendan Gale as CEO in that sense. So what was your experience of the club when you walked in?
Well, I was really lucky. It was the right time. They'd done an enormous amount of work to build themselves, put themselves in a position to be able to win, I thought. A pretty good, very good list. And I think they'd done a lot of work on nearly all the things they needed to, but it was really quite interesting because Damien's a really, really good coach and a good fella. And I remember when I first got there, I went and spoke to quite a few of the players, and quite a few of the older blokes said, "Oh God," he said, "like last year we just felt that he was all too negative with us, and this, you know, it was always, you know, not quite good enough and whatever." And to be fair, we didn't win a few games, but it was more his attitude towards. He felt that his most important job as a coach was to make sure if someone did something wrong. Which is true. As a coach, you have to. But his attitude was to say, what they were saying is they, in the end, felt really negative about it, because he was really saying, "You got that wrong. You know, make sure you get it right." So I was with Blair Hartley, and we were just talking about. So he came into a meeting, and I wanted, you know, we're going to front up to this and see what he says about it. And I virtually said to him, "I mean, some of the players, they're hating you, mate. You can't be a great coach unless they love you." Looked at me, and poor old Blair thought, "Oh, where's this going? These two are mad."
Hartley's, just so people, Blair Hartley's the list manager who's put this group together. Yeah.
Well, it's only because he was worried about how I was challenging Damien, and so we talked about it, and I said, "Well, I can see this out there, but I said, you know, you're in a good place. Things are working, but this is probably the one thing you know, if you just do recognize this, and who knows what can happen." And I said something like when someone does something wrong, there's two ways of telling them. One is to say, "You weak bastard, what did you do that for?" Or the other way is, "Look, this is what happened. Do you recognize that, you know, we need to get better at this?" "Yes, we do." "Okay. What do you need to do, and how can I help you?" is saying exactly the same thing, yeah, but it's a different, you know, again, this is me. But we had the meeting, and he's thinking about it, which is good, and Blair was worried about it. But then 2 days later, he gets a big note from Damien with all the players in and the strengths he's going to coach him to and he's going to work on. So it was and fortunately, I think Damien had been to the US and done a little bit of work.
I think he did the Authentic Leadership Program. Yeah, I think so.
So it was already very much in his mind, or I think I just reinforced what you know, we needed to do in a way. But it was, you know, I take the credit for it, of course, because that's what I do. But that was what they did, and we were after that. It was we hadn't played yet, so who knows? He probably would have done that anyway. But I felt that was something that, you know, we needed to, you know, look at.
Mm.
And certainly the players really, you know, appreciated. They got on so well in the end. It was very good.
So how did you go with that conversation? Because basically you're really asking him to change, aren't you, in one way or another?
Challenging. I was challenging him to say, "Well, I reckon this works. Let's have a look at it." And it wasn't much, you know, most of the players he would be doing that, but the odd one he was challenging a bit too much. And But I think that's what clubs make you do. So he'd been there for a while. Hadn't really won anything yet. 2016 got a pretty good list. Not playing as well as they should. He's not protecting himself so much, but protecting his role by saying, "Well, if they're doing things wrong, I've got to make sure they know."
Yeah.
And that is what the coach needs to do. But again, he needs to do it in a way that it's easy for them, not easier for them to fix. And it's a bit about that, you know, buy-in and all that sort of stuff and values. So really, they were in the right place, and he knew it. But it was just they needed to take a breath and go, "Okay, let's believe in ourselves. Let's do what we do well." Mm. And then he started coaching. "So look, you know, I accept it. You make mistakes. Let's get on with it. Don't worry about making a mistake. But next time, we know what to do. Let's do it." And it was very much about that, letting them be who they were, but encouraging them to believe that they're good enough. So just keep at it, and they were quite outstanding.
Mm. And then in terms of your ongoing role with that, what type of conversation, what would be the type of conversation that someone like yourself would have with, you know, the person who's ultimately, you know, he's in front of the team every week or every day, he's confronting the media, having to be, you know, up for grabs every time he plays. What sort of conversations would you have with him?
Oh, it was really very much just encouraging him. Don't believe all that. Don't worry about all the stuff that's happening outside. We know what we're doing. You know what you're doing in here. You're controlling it well. You've got terrific support. Players know they just play to that. Don't worry too much. If they ask you a question about somebody who's not playing well, say, you know, we encourage them to be as good as they can be, and we'll work it out inside rather than even being, you know, part of it. And I vividly remember him saying in the after the captain's run before the grand final in 17, what he said to the players. And it was very much, it was very powerful because you normally, you go in there and I think it was Ange Postecoglou or something told a team, they had written it up that, you know, don't, make sure you don't waste this opportunity and blah, 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 which is pretty bloody obvious. But it almost put over, you know, imposed on the players. And Damien honestly came into the meeting and says, look, whatever happens from now, in my mind, you've won. Been outstanding and got ourselves in this position. Just be really proud of it. He said, now, there is a game to play and, you know, for us to really be that, we've got to win it. He said, but think about the last 40 steps up Everest. Just take a step at a time. We'll take a step at a time and we win this game, there's no doubt. Just think of it that way. But I'm telling you, you're good enough and you should be proud of what you've done to here. But this is the last little job and just treat it. And it was really to take that ridiculous pressure off, oh, we either win or we don't. Because the either most people react to that by saying, I hope I don't stuff it up, rather than new beauty, what a great opportunity, next step up Everest. And it was, and I actually wrote it down, thought this is something special. And I noticed, looked at it the other day when I was looking through some old notes and I'd forgotten it had happened. Very, very powerful. And you know that the players, they'll remember that forever as well. I know he believes in us because if we lose, he's not going to say it's your fault. We won't lose because we'll do all this.
Yeah.
It's very powerful. Yeah.
No, that's wonderful. And it's interesting that you sort of recognise it in the moment as well. Like with all the experience you've had, you're thinking, wow, this is actually – there's another layer. Yeah,
because the easiest way to go as a coach is just say, you bastards, don't let me down. Don't make me look like a shit coach by losing today, which is obviously not that helpful really.
No. So is there – did you help Damien see something in himself that he hadn't – quite, or he'd lost at some point?
I don't think so. I think he just reacted to the stress of the situation the year before, or going, well, you know, everyone's saying you've been here for a while, what's going on? You need to get, you know, I think he reacted a bit to that and made sure that he covered everything he had to cover. But I think it's just, you know, we all suffer that bit of anxiety of it, you know, make sure it happens, otherwise, you know, what can happen here? And I think I just reminded him what he knew was right anyway. Because his relationship with the players was terrific. You know, it was a very – he drove them well. You know, they liked the fact that he expected them to play well, but they also, you know, knew he was there for them. So I don't think it changed. I think it just, you know, refocused a little bit on what he had to do. Mm. And particularly those blokes, most of them were the older blokes who knew what they were doing and they really committed, but it was almost, oh, God. You know, I know I made a mistake. Don't worry about it.
So. Yeah. Had the senior players almost given up on the idea of – winning a premiership?
No, I don't think so. No, I think we're in a very good place. They were in a very good place from that point of view that we'd, you know, made the list decisions. We'd worked hard at it. We'd got a bloody good list of players together. They were real playing pretty well together. But it was just that next step, I think, the next step of actually doing it and believing in themselves.
It seems that almost all of your mindset stuff comes back to the idea about people feeling themselves.
Well, and feeling good about themselves, but being prepared to suffer the pain of it. We know there's discomfort in all of that. But
does that help them feel better about themselves once they've come through the pain? And
well, I think it does. I think, you know, if you aren't intelligent enough to recognise what has to be done, you won't feel good about yourself. You too short term, well, you will, but it won't be meaningful. So I think, as we said before, it's the balance of all that. Recognise what you have to do. If you're not prepared to work hard, you're not prepared to do the training, you're not prepared to learn the game, you're not prepared to practice, you're not prepared to do all the shit that's too hard, if you're not prepared to do that, you won't get this. Mm. So you've got to not necessarily suffer the pain, but accept the challenge and the difficulty of getting there. You know, I think I'm wise. I'm sort of like broad enough thinker to recognise all that. Don't have to love it, but know you have to do it.
Yeah. Where does that wisdom come from for you? Because it would be the thing which would strike most people, and it's certainly one of the reasons I always enjoy every chat, is that there's always a nuance in every conversation. There's never, you know, in a world which is, you know, particularly in sport, can be very binary, you know, either hero or villain, good. good, bad, premiership coach, non-premiership coach, successful because you are, or successful or unsuccessful because you're not, that you've always brought sort of something which sits right in that place where it can go either way for people, but you would generally push to the positive, I would think.
Yeah, always. I think I'm naturally broad-minded. I mean, I think I see the possibilities all the time. It's like I read somewhere when someone said that we seem to worry about something like paranoia, but paranoia is really just knowing all the facts, what can possibly happen, and then dealing with them. So paranoia sounds a negative, but I'm sort of paranoid as well as optimistic in the same way, is that I think I can see what may happen all the time, not all the time. But I can see there are other things that might happen. There are other things that are possible, and how do we fiddle this into this? Which I think it's sort of natural with me.
Do you work at it?
Well, I don't think I do. I work at it in that if I think it, I think it through. I don't deny it.
Does pen hit paper or anything like that, or it's just you?
Well, sometimes, but no, not really. It's more happening now. And you deal with it now rather than writing it down and come back in a week's time and do it. Although some things I have to do like that, but mostly it's about dealing with what happens now, particularly in, you know, in my life in footy. There's a bit about preparing for the future, which we have to do, but most of it is dealing with what's happening now. How do we play a bit better? How does this go? How do we deal with this bloke who's not quite making it, or this kid's playing up off the field, or coach is not quite, you know, is not feeling that well, what do we do? I think it's seeing all the possibilities around those things and, you know, trying to come up with a positive outcome.
And how much is it helping others see those possibilities as well, as in drawing, because it's not just you, is it? You'll bring your own.
Oh, it doesn't. Well, it's like in coaching, it doesn't really matter what the coach thinks or knows. Yeah. It only matters what the player does based on what he knows, and it's the same in that. If you don't get other people to understand what their problems are and help themselves with it, it don't make no difference.
And I'm thinking also about the collective ideas that organisationally we have to buy in on. So we're heading down this track.
Yeah. I hate authority for the sake of authority. I don't know whether you've noticed that.
No, you do. But you will. So you will bring your idea and your imagination into the room, but it also relies on others to do that as well. How do you create conditions that, like, if you're in a group, and very, very strong personalities you've had to deal with over time, whereby you can operate within those that strong personality type, bringing your own strong personality into the room, but knowing that the goal is to actually for this room to come up with the best way forward here, and that goes, and we know that we're not going to agree, because we're not going to agree, because it's not something which is agreeable to, because it's complex, it's layered, it's nuanced, it's all those things.
Well, I think I make sure that I at least listen to the other people's opinion and take it into account, and I might even change my view on it at times when they do it. I think you have to do that. But when I know it's absolutely categorically wrong, I'm probably not that easy to deal with. But, but those are things that happen. I mean, but, yeah, you've got to be easy. Not easy to deal with, but the people have got to know that you're prepared to recognise what they say, because you're not the only one who knows anything. They do know things, and maybe it is a better outcome. Maybe your thoughts plus their thoughts mean, wow, we've got the answer. I think I've always been reasonably prepared for that. People think that, I probably do have an opinion on everything and argue sometimes for the sake of arguing, but I very quickly say, really just arguing about this, what's really the outcome. I think I do that reasonably quickly. But I think it means that you've got to have respect for the other people and respect for their ideas, even if you don't like them.
Yeah.
And I think that's, it's funny, you look at, the international stuff that's going on, what's Donald Trump doing, and you look at it, you know that what he's doing in these really significant situations is just, he's just negotiating like a businessman. You tell them this, see what happens. And if they don't accept it, at least we've raised the bar on expectation. What about we do something else? I mean, I don't particularly like that style that much, but that's part of what we have to do, isn't it?
That is. It is that encouragement of we actually do need to hear your idea. That if you actually are creating an environment where, particularly with, you know, a strong person inside that, that ultimately people know that it's just going to turn to what they have, whatever that person thinks anyway.
Yeah. Yeah,
so to be in a room full of very capable people and not be prepared to try and draw the best from their capability is I find that to be part of the big challenge, because clearly you need to have a view coming into the room and you need to have a fairly formed view. And there's, and I've spoken a bit on this podcast, there's a wonderful music producer, Rick Rubin, who talks about this idea of your idea, best idea. So you, the only way we get to best idea is if we get to hear your idea.
Mm.
Yeah, and the idea that I came in with, I might still feel is the best idea, but you know, and he talks about it in the context of music production, where you've got a lot of strong egos in bands and those sorts of things. And
yeah, but that's the power of management, of course. I mean, if you like, do you trust people? Like, if you're appointed as footy manager somewhere, you've got to hope that the people who appoint you trust that you know what you're doing. Now you don't have to. They are there to help you when if they're not sure and they think there's something else you need to know. But essentially, they've got to believe in you anyway, I think. So you shouldn't, if you're forever, every day, having to convince them of something, I mean, one, either you or they are not the right person for the job.
Yeah. But, so what do they need to trust? Is it a they need to trust you in terms of what trust, you bring, your philosophical view of how you're going to approach the role you're playing.
Yeah.
And if it ever becomes contrary to those things, well, you're up for grabs then, aren't you?
Well, you are. And that's but then they've, you know, you've got to always do what you say you're going to do. You've got to be, you know, honest and, you know, every now and again you might have to sneak around some things, but you're essentially doing what you say you're going to do, treating people properly. If you have to make the tough decision, which sometimes you do, make sure you do it for the right reasons. You're not just doing it to satisfy yourself. And it's all those, you know, simple things about for the good of the organisation or for most people rather than just the good for your own good.
Yeah.
I think you have to do that.
And how do you go about – so you've won the trust of the people who have appointed you. Now you've got to win the trust of the people you've now got to work with.
Yeah, well, it's you've got to do what you say you're going to do. You've got to approach them, tell them that you're there for them and then make decisions that are good for all of us. And there'll be some times that you have to make a decision that they might not like, but as long as if you're able to sit with you say, well, this is why we had to do it, it is ultimately for the common good. It's not just to make sure we look right. And fortunately, particularly in footy, we're much more likely to give people a second chance nowadays. We want to, you know, burn you off, send you to somewhere else. But that's part of the role. Yeah.
And so that is so you consciously explain. So when you come into an environment, you explain to people these are my thoughts and philosophies on that I bring in regard to how you build the sorts of environments to get the best out of you, and then over time build track record in support of
pretty
that.
Well. Yeah, and it's, you know, kind of logical, really. You do what you say you're going to do and that's what happens. But then you've got to be able to, you know, sometimes there's a circumstance that needs something a bit different and you've got to have the courage, if you like, to do what you believe is right. Like, I mean, in the old days, the coaches and they wouldn't ever ask the players what they thought, whereas a lot of the decision-making that we need to make in this relies on what the players think, because they've got to play with the guy. If he's played up or done something or not playing as well as he should or whatever, you know, you go to them and say, well, what do you think? And if they think the same as you do, it may even be them that deal with it if they do it in the right way rather than, you know, the organiser, you know. The buffet at the top doesn't have to be the one who's always saying, come on. They can say, well, look, if you want to be part of this, we need you to try. Can you recognise that? And so I think it's you've got to have the, you know, the lateral thinking in a sense to be able to say, well, there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah. So that's challenging the person themselves to take responsibility ultimately without having to impose.
And within their playing group, if you know what I mean. And that's all. It will, and it, whoever does it, you've got to challenge them to do it. There's no, if you're forever going to have to be, you know, given the cuts if they don't do it, well, you need, they need to go.
Yeah, yeah. And you would have faced both those scenarios.
Yeah, quite a bit at different times, yeah.
Yeah. Because the one that comes to mind is Stevie Johnson at Geelong.
Who
ends up being, you know, one of the great players. But there was probably a time when you might have questioned whether.
Oh, well, it's a really he's a terrific guy, Steve. A bit naughty, which is why I like him. But and when I not long after I got down to Geelong, he, you know, he was found somewhere, you know, in the backyard, someone's backyard, you know, buggered or drunk or some bloody thing. And I remember the even the players were saying, "Oh God, he's forever doing this. What the hell do we do with him?" And there was a feeling that, you know, he was he wasn't we weren't able to fix him or help him. And I remember I said to him, I said, "Well, the only thing I can tell you is that if we get rid of him, are you going to be in that back out again next week?" Mm. "Yeah, well, probably, but, you know, that's his fault." So, "But if we don't, all we're doing is taking a risk and giving him a second chance. And the next time he's in the backyard, we can burn him off if that's what you want to do. But shouldn't we think about that?" And that was when I actually said to, it was Tommy Harley and the boys, I said, "Well, why don't you blokes sit down with him and try and work out a solution to this?" And it was really, it was a wonderful thing to have done, because he was really, you know, he was almost crying in the meeting. "So I know I've stuffed up, but I, you know, I love playing and da 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 da." And so they went through it all and they got a really strong commitment from him and what he was going to do. And we actually, I think we banned him for 4 or 5 weeks. And I mean, it was really quite a significant thing. But he just trained his way up there and got there, and he wins the Norm Smith medal that year and we win the flag. Well, you know, it's pretty strong support for the fact that we gave him another chance. Now, he was, you know, everyone's a little bit different and they have their own personalities, but, you know, he got it and the players got it with him to say, "Well, okay, if you do this, we've got your back." And he finished up, you know, champion of a player anyway, but, you know, to win the Norm Smith medal in that year, it sort of justified what we did in a sense.
Did that change the game, do you think? Or the way we approach these things?
Well, I think it does. I think we're a lot, as a organisation, we're a lot better at taking the people into account. And even now, the way we trade people and work with them. And you make sure that we're looking at after the players good, after them as well as just us. In the good old days, "Oh, we need some space, we need to piss someone off, let's go, let's..." And the bloke didn't even have a say in it, whereas now we'll often trade someone because it's for their benefit.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to play enough and they want to play and, "Well, okay, we'll help you go somewhere," rather than, you know, "Hope you break your leg and never get another kick." Mm. And in a funny way, you know, the clubs, particularly, say, Richmond, quite a few of our people are now out doing some really significant things in other clubs, and we're proud of that, in that they're one of ours, and one of our guys. We hope they do well, not when they're playing us.
Yes.
But, you know, the coaches are out there, like half of them have been through our club, as I think, you know, I mean, Hawthorn could probably say the same again, quite a significant number, and you feel proud of it because you're contributing to the AFL, contributing to the game, and giving your people an opportunity to do something somewhere else. I think we're a lot better at that now than we ever were.
It's almost the ultimate measure, isn't it, is how well, or the influence of your former people
in
the game,
so.
Almost from really a legacy perspective. Is legacy a driver for you at all?
Oh, no, I think about tomorrow rather than yesterday all the time. So I suppose when I look back, I'm quite, you know, proud of the fact that I've been to lots of places and they've been pretty good, and I'm sort of recognised for that. But most of the people who know me know that I carry that sack around and there's nothing in it, and I've never actually done anything. But
So explain that a bit more. So it's just as in, you know, you're here now and you're here for the moment type of thing, or is that how you feel?
Well, it's not so much that. I'm just looking forward rather than back, that's all. But
because there is what, 8 premiership cups in the sack.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I never think about that. I always think about the next one, but who knows?
It's a remarkable legacy though, isn't it?
Oh, I do. Well, I treat I say Richmond Footy Club's my legacy because I played there. I mean, footy's about playing more than anything else, because it's a total commitment and risk and all that stuff. But I'm really still very proud of all the places I've been to. Really, still got a great feeling towards them. Still see quite a few people from nearly all of them. So I am much more. I even respect Port Adelaide now. There you are. That's how serious I am. Don't love them, but I respect them.
It's interesting because you've stepped into another role with
and Carlton.
Yeah, and as a Richmond bloke, and people know I'm doing a little bit of stuff with the Blues. That's the hardest one, I think. You step into the Adelaide role now you're playing, which is more part time in that sense. If you were to explain to someone what it is that you think you bring, how would you describe it? I'm thinking through the lens of a leader here in this way.
Well, I think I bring a sense of reality but a reality and belief at times. Because I look at them now, I think, you know, I shouldn't be talking about Adelaide. Probably board members aren't supposed to do that. But they just look like, you know, they're a damn good team and they've got a lot of opportunities. Now, we know that's not it. You've got to do it and there's all the challenges within it. But I think as much as anything else, you know, I've always believed that if you get it right, the answer is usually in the room. You know, like, you know, if they get it right and work together and all the players buy into that team thing and bust their gut when they need to but do it for the next bloke rather than just for them, and all those kind of almost throwaway words they talk about nowadays. If you do that, you've got a real chance of winning. And it's better, it's more, you've got to have the talent in your team. You've got to have enough talent, but you don't have to necessarily have the most talent. Mm. You've just got to have a good balance of the team. You know what you're doing. You stick to the rules. You play your game properly. You play your role. The coach is always positive about what you're doing, but is still prepared to make the hard decisions and always, again, throwaway lines. But if you do it, the answer's often in the room. And I think that's what, you know, not that I'll have that much influence over all of them because the board's a bit different to working full time, but if I bring anything, it'll be that believe in yourselves, boys. Just get the most out of yourselves. Be as good as you can be, like as Damien said. And then take your chances when they come. Believe in yourself and do it. So who knows? You know, and you get away with that more days than once because Chris Fagan's the coach of the premiership team. You look at him, you go, how could he be that? He's not a mean, miserable, nasty driver, but he's a bloody good coach and a good person and they've got the right people around him. And so anything's possible in today's footy from that point of view. You've just got to get the players working together and doing the right stuff.
Yeah, but that's just actually a wonderful articulation of any challenge for any leader is to actually look into the room and say your future's in the room.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we're going to have to do some work together.
And sometimes the leader might say, well, it's not in the room because in footy not so much, but even in footy, when you're not ready yet, well, you've got to recognise that. Like Adam Uzay, for example, he looks in the room and says, look, I'm really proud of what you do every week and there's a chance you can win every week, but we know that's we're going to be better than that soon because you'll get better and we'll do this and we'll do that. So you don't have to necessarily be winning the flag, but you've got to know where you are. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges in footy. In the good old days, Richmond, we didn't know where we were because if we didn't win, we sacked someone.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't necessarily the right thing to do because it wasn't recognising the reality. You know, we'll blame someone else for it and move on, but then the next year's worse and took us a long time to get out of it because I don't think we saw the reality easily enough.
And I think all business and all organisations still can potentially go down that track.
You know, of course.
Because it is nagging at you, it is gnawing at you, it is all those sorts of things. And there's a wonderful line which almost all my leadership stuff around now is define reality, give definition to reality, but give hope.
Yeah,
define reality, give hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is even in watching, you know, the Tigers winning round one was, and I do little pieces on this now with a drawing and it was Sam Lawler, and I think it was that idea of define reality, give hope.
Yeah.
That in the shadows of three premierships is a group trying to rebuild itself, you know, but it's not doing it, you know, the shadow of those premierships is still playing. It's 7 or 8 of those players are still in the squad. So it's not – that's actually part of its reality but also part of its hope.
Yeah, and it's very hard for, you know, footy's about winning now, everyone thinks, but we know it ain't. And particularly, I mean, the AFL have created the circumstance where, you know, we're looking for giving every club the opportunity to win at some stage, and to do that it means that the other 17 don't win.
Mm.
And it's necessary, but we've got to understand that, you know, there's work to do within that. Mm. I mean, and Richmond know they've got work to do. They've sort of let 4 or 5 absolutely sensational players go, but they kind of wanted to go, and it kind of made sense. Well, but all right, let's take the big risk.
Yeah.
I mean, and Essendon is probably not dissimilar. We're all thinking Essendon, but you know that you look at they got the second youngest team or whatever. Mm. We sort of didn't realise that. But they're trying to do that as well. You know, they're getting the young kids in, hoping they get better, get a few other players in. So, and it's not as easy to do as it looks, obviously, because everyone's trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
But that's why I say you've just got to take notice of what you're doing inside. Don't worry too much about all the talk outside, because unfortunately there's footy media everywhere nowadays, and they've all got to say something.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting one too, because I think sometimes, and even when I'm coaching, you know, say Michael Boss, can't I say, look, there's noise, yeah. But every so often the noise is a bit of a signal as well. Is it actually telling you something? And to actually be a little bit discerning is important, you know, that, you know, you have to be aware that there are, you know, 100,000, you know, current members who are probably not feeling as good as they possibly could at this moment or whatever. But also sometimes it becomes a bit of a racket. It becomes a little bit political in that sense as well.
Well, it becomes political if your club don't understand where you are.
Yeah.
Now, it's a bit harder for Vossi probably than others, because he's got half a dozen of the highest paid best players going around. Mm. So, well, surely you've got enough players. Well, then there's that develop around them as well. And, you know, it's always, I mean, there's no easy games nowadays. That's the issue. Like, if they play Richmond first round, Richmond aren't going to win a game, and they knock them over. Mm. And that's because they probably got a bit anxious, worried about the fact that was going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that clearly Bossy would see and work with and help them with, and they play a lot better the next week, and they will be okay. Well, in my opinion, they will be. But it's a bit of a challenge, though, I must say. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, like, you look at coaches and you think, well, I don't know what they're doing, but he looks like the sort of bloke I wouldn't mind playing for, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not a good thing anyway, if I'm prepared to play for him.
Well, I can talk all day with you.
As you noticed, so can I.
Yeah, and I was just, because it might be feel a little bit indulgent, but my father played a big role in your recruitment when you were only, it was like a little window opened up, wasn't it?
16 going on 17.
16 yeah. going on 17, yeah. So I think Dad was only, I think, 27, 28 himself at that stage, yeah.
Well, I was that young, he looked old. Yeah. No, he was very, very important to me. Even in the simplicity of his negotiation, because it was different in those days, there was no drafting and all that sort of stuff. And there was I think it was Coulter Law time where West Australian and South Australian players had to sit out for 12 months to play. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it was Cole Beard and couple of blokes at Carlton, Sid Jackson. Who was the other one? I know the other one very well. But anyway, they had to sit out. I'd played some senior footy in Perth for Subi, but I was still going to school, so I wasn't part of that. So I was eligible to go to any club, and I'd played a couple of senior games as a 16-year-old. So I was sort of in their view, I guess. And then quite a few clubs spoke to us, but Richmond, who we hadn't spoken to at all. We landed at Essendon Airport. That's how long ago it was. And there to meet us is Dad, Graham Richmond, Ron Carson, and Jack Dyer. Can you buy? So they figured it out. Oh, we'll go over the top here. So they've driven us to the Royal Hotel or Royal Parade Hotel or whatever it was, hotel we're staying at, and we're going, oh, this is pretty impressive. And at that stage, in Dad's work, he worked for Nestle and those, and a few of the people were attached to Collingwood, so they'd been trying to recruit him, we reckon. We said to my brother Ian, and I said, well, he's not going to play, we're going to play, they need to be talking to us.
Yeah.
And they were a bit, but Richmond were clever, I reckon. Alan was very smart. He finished up, we're at chatting away, and then finally he says, He looked around and he said, our team's going to the Gold Coast next week for a pre-season trip. If you sign, you can come. And we said, where do we sign? And we spent a week or so in the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
But it was though huge money in those days. I think I got paid $1,000 to sign or something. Yeah. But he was terrific. He was because they were crazy days in a way, but he was really positive. And I think he read the game really well. It was all, you know, pretty kind of driven and regimented and all that sort of stuff. And Alan, he was kind of the one you could go and have a chat to and, you know, say, oh, look, you know, what it's really about is this. Mm. So he was very, very aware of people, I thought. Yeah. Or maybe I was a bit too obvious. But he was. I always remember one day I did something in the under-19s at 69. I was playing at school, playing a school game while I was playing 19s, and the umpire gave a silly free kick in the ruck to the opposite, and I thought anyway. And the umpire's put his foot down to show me the mark, and I trod on his foot. Oh, sorry. And someone was there watching it, and I got dragged into his office with Slug. Slug was the under-19s coach. And Slug had to give me the payout for it. Oh, God. Am I in the weakest in the world? And what are you doing that for? And I said, oh, well, sorry, Ben. I know I shouldn't have done it. And I walked out thinking, surely they could have just said, what did you do that for? And don't do it again. And, I got it. But I get the best payout of all time. But I think that's what they had to do in those days. And I remember, I think Alan was just sitting there going. But he was terrific. He was really good for me, I must admit.
Yeah. No, I know he was always really proud of you. And right to the, you know, he was, there was always, something, you know, you used to come around to our home and all those sorts of stuff when they'd have the play out at Waverley. We lived in Mount Waverley, have little after match functions at home and all that sort of stuff. And the bloke I always wanted to get within the vicinity of was the bloke who looked like a bass player in a rock band, as well as, you know, he's kicking 50 goals.
I just
goals.
Couldn't afford to go to the hairdresser.
the long, beautiful.
Well, there wasn't a hairdresser, it would have been a barber.
It would have been a barber, the luscious locks and all that sort of stuff. And I've got to say, it's been a pleasure just knowing you over this period of time. And you've been incredibly generous to me all through my working life, even though there was a time when I had to come and tap you on the shoulder and say, you know, mate, it's.
Well, see, even then I understood what that meant. I knew it wasn't you saying, I don't reckon you're any good. It was you saying, look, we needed to do better and my job is to tell you.
Yeah, and it really was only my job. Yeah, and it was a crazy time. And when I realised the numbers were working against you, and I remember actually did ring the president of the club at the time and say, look, I know that you're doing the numbers behind me back here. I'm just going to go down and tell him.
Yeah.
And that's how it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was. I know it's always dramatic and traumatic when you have to deliver those messages, but I know it's always much more dramatic and traumatic for the person who's receiving.
Yeah, I haven't copped it all that often, but it wasn't much fun. But nevertheless, it was the best thing ever happened to me. It told me there's other things to do in footy, and maybe you should do them. But
yeah, and I've often wondered that. You know, where you probably in today's environment, you probably would have coached again.
Probably. And I was lucky in that I'd had. Like we had jobs, real jobs in the old days when we played, so I had a fair bit of commercial background as well, so it probably made it easier for me to get into footy management or club football management. Yeah.
No, you've had an unbelievable career, and just everywhere you've gone it's been successful, and I hope may that long continue. But I think there was a special moment when it was the Tigers
to go back to your club. I sort of can't ever forget that feeling at the end of that. It was nearly as good as the feeling when on Dusty's 300th when he kicked that goal in the first minute. I wish I had gone home after that.
That was again knowing the role you've played with those sorts of people, and I talked about legacy before, and I know it's not a sack of anything for you, but I know it is for the people who've had something to do with you over that period of time, that what you've actually left with them, I think it's the legacy, and how I feel. Yeah. Knowing you over all this time.
Sorry to bore the shit of everyone. Bore the shit out of everyone. But.
No. I knew that we were going to have much more of a footy conversation today, and I was really up for that. So thank you. That's cool.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us in the arena, Bummy. It's been
absolute
great
pleasure.